Yeah, so we're very honored to have you here today, tonight with us. And Charlotte Hamburn studied under the great master, Pao Zaidel, Venerable Pao Zaidel. And you've also accumulated about 9 years worth of silent retreat experience, is that right? Wow, probably a little bit longer than that, so you said that some time ago. So honored to have you here as well. And how are we doing? Up a little bit higher. Okay. Can you do that better?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, so the topic for tonight is the deeper states of samadhi. And we've only got about an hour for that, and really 45 minutes now. So we may go a little bit longer, and I hope everyone's okay with that. But I might just get us started, and because we want to get the most out of this. We want to go as deep as we can, right? Okay, so I guess maybe a way to start, let's jump straight into it. Maybe a way to start is, Shailen, if you could start to clarify for us what distinguishes deep states of meditation from, you know, a particular kind of mindfulness practice.
Well, actually at this conference we've been discussing the theme of what's beyond mindfulness. And it may be that when we consider the Eightfold Path, we find that right samadhi is what's beyond right mindfulness. So then the question is, well, what really is the difference between mindfulness and samadhi, between sati and samadhi? And the stillness of mind, the unification of mind that describes and is the experience of the state of samadhi is quite profound. And we can become very concentrated, still, unified, aware in various modes. And sometimes we can be observing the different states of changing nature of body and mind, which we certainly do emphasize with mindfulness practices. But with the samadhi practices, the mind becomes very still and unified in that perception. And there are kinds of samadhi that develop in connection with the mind and body processes, which with perception and with feeling and with the changing nature of body and mind. But there are also deep states called the jhanas. The first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and fourth jhana. Not very creative names, I know. But there are states in which the mind becomes absorbed with the object, where the mind becomes so steady that it develops a clarity and a fitness that is very profound.
So you made a distinction between right mindfulness and right samadhi, and it's about the unification of the mind. And you also mentioned the word jhana. So I just wanted to, you know, make a distinction. How do you just, you know, the word samadhi and the word jhana, how do you, is there a distinction between those two Pali words?
Well, I would use the term samadhi to refer to a unification of mind that can occur in many different forms of meditation practice, including vipassana and insight practices. But I would consider the four jhanas to be very specific states of absorptive concentration, where the mind becomes absorbed with a suitable object. And each of the four jhanas, each of these four states, is characterized by particular experiences of equanimity. And they're also distinct from mindfulness practices, in that mindfulness usually refers to mindfulness of the sense experiences, whereas the absorption states of jhana, although they are states of mindfulness, they develop through a continuity of mindfulness. They're not other than mindfulness. But the experience can withdraw from the entanglement with just being mindful of seeing their anxiety and attraction to experience an absorptive state.
Ajahn Brahm, so these jhanic states, how would one know that they're going into this type of absorption as opposed to a standard form of samadhi?
First of all, your five senses are not available. So where they say being apart, we which able can't pull your heart separated from the sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and just with that sixth sense of mind, and fully aware, powerfully aware, because one of the functions of those jhanas is to suppress what we call the five hindrances. It's the five hindrances which distort the cognitive process. So while you're in jhana, you really are, for this now, powerful. This is not just an ordinary state. Even in the sutras and the Vinaya, it's called a state of simply superhuman state, literally manusa, dharma. So this is fantastic state. It is so strong and powerful that as a Buddhist monk, who actually is obliged to keep their Vinaya practices, we are not permitted to announce that we have attained any of those states. Sometimes it can be quite frustrating, because people think that, okay, because they ask me, can you achieve these things whenever you want? If I say yes, I get into trouble. If I say no, I get into trouble. I'm breaking my precepts. That is how important, now, the Buddha valued those states. They're powerful. And anyone who's experienced those states knows their strength, their power, and their goodness. But sometimes the people get scared of those states. One of the reasons is because in those states you temporarily lose your ego, your sense of self. So your will vanishes from the second jhana onwards. And that is as scary as can be. You're no longer in charge of this process.
So what you're describing is a state where you're freed from the five senses.
You're not just free, they're just not there.
They're not there anymore.
Yeah.
And you're left with the sixth consciousness.
Yes.
And then you even going deeper, you mentioned only the second jhana where you lose will itself.
Indeed. One of the reasons for that is that you're so confident in that stillness that there is no more movement of mind possible. Diamond-like samadhi, where nothing moves. Which is one of the reasons why that if you start enjoying and benefiting from those states, if you don't make the resolution beforehand, how long are you going to stay in there? Once in, it's impossible to come out until the karmic forces, that's the best way you can call it, the amount of letting go and renunciation you had when you brought in the jhanas, when that runs out, then you'll come out. In Sydney, so I like telling anecdotes. In Sydney just some years ago, it wasn't myself, it wasn't even a Western monk, a monk from another... it was Theravada, started a meditation retreat, 9 days, usually half an hour meditation, followed by the first talk on a Friday night. He never gave a talk on a Friday night. He never went to bed. He never slept. He never ate. He sat there for 8 days without moving, without going to the toilet, without drinking, without eating. And when he came out, he apologized. He said, I was supposed to give you a talk, but I made the mistake that I entered one of these deep jhanas and I never actually told myself when I was supposed to come out. So for 8 days he was in there. And the people who saw this were actually really impressed. They said, you never gave us any talk through words, but just seeing that this is possible in today's world was a great inspiration. And to hear that you've done how many... years of silence, 6 months or something, 9 years of silent retreats, and that's inspiring.
So I'm not going to ask Ajahn Bam if he's ever entered the jhanic state, but I'll assume he has. And
can I actually answer that?
Because please.
It was a
frustration, and then making sure that people don't get the wrong message, and also saying something which is important about these jhanic states. And a few years ago, Shaila, I just frustrated and said, okay, I can understand the loophole. And I say to all those people who have any faith or confidence in me, and who've listened to my talks, read that book on mindfulness, bliss and beyond, and I say, Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. I can't do it. And then before people go to the door and say fraud, I say that Ajahn Brahm has to disappear. My sense of self, ego, someone who's attaining something, who's actually doing it, that is what I have to leave behind. And when you leave that sense of self behind, the doer, the controller, the whatever, then those jhanas happen.
I think this, people who've done mostly mindfulness in a secular way might often wonder what is attractive about withdrawing from the senses. But when we realize through our understanding of the way we perceive the world is that very often a deluded mind is when we see, when we hear, when we taste. We're constructing a sense of self again and again and again and again through the way we perceive ordinary things. And so to give the mind a rest from all of that, from all that conceiving of self, that drops away in the movement away from the sense doors. We're no longer needing to keep reconceiving ourselves from the five senses, and we're no longer engaged in discursive thought processes, which also keep constructing the self. And that provides such a profound experience of rest that is not a dull rest. It's actually energetic because we're not drained all the time with that exhausting pursuit of self-construction.
So then what would you say is the payoff of jhanic states? So you're describing a few benefits, like you're seeing the constructive nature of the mind, you're seeing it's also giving a sort of rest and energy to the mind. What's the actual goal of reaching jhana?
There's a quote from the Samyutta Nikaya that says, where the Buddha said, develop concentration. One who is concentrated understands things as they really are. That's the real payoff, is that when we are concentrated, the mind is stable, is able to have a clear perception of things. If we're not concentrated and we're just seeing things at the superficial level of how things are, then we might sure have, we'll have some degree of insight, but we'll probably have insights into the way that we are distracted, the way that we are encountering the hindrances, the way that we, our personality insights. But to get below all of that, we have to have a still mind. We have to have a fit, strong mind to really have the kind of insights that cannot just free us from one particular thought pattern or one particular hindrance, but actually cut through the patterns of conditioning. And I think concentration is a critical component of and support for liberating insight. Now, sure, there's a lot of other benefits, and often when people come to they come to a jhana retreat, often in the back of their minds is the desire to bliss out. Mm-hmm. You know, the desire to experience these states of happiness that are beyond sensual pleasures. But I think that when you ask what the aim is, what the purpose is, I mean, what right samadhi depends upon is right view, which is the aim of liberation.
So right view is the payoff in some sense.
Right view supports and enables right samadhi, and right samadhi strengthens the possibility for right view to bring it to liberation. Mm-hmm. They all work together. It's not really linear.
Yeah, so there's a support network there.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for telling me. I feel like I'm eating it, but okay.
So Ajahn Brahm, could you tell us a little bit about the relationship between samadhi, jhana, and insight, and let's go to liberation as well.
Very good. To add something there from my own teacher, Ajahn Chah, who said we always meditate to let go, not to attain things. And I remember that so clearly. He repeated it often. You don't get into a jhana by trying to attain it. The more you let go, the more you renounce, that's part of the right view, which you sometimes have to start with, the more you let go and renounce, the easier it comes. So for many people, their jhanas become in spite of them, often unexpected, often just out of the blue, it happens. And the benefits of that is two things. First of all, to the data. You've been in a jhana. And this is what the Buddha was talking about. Number one, he described it as sambodhisukha, the joy, the bliss of enlightenment, awakening. So when we had that panel about, you know, what is awakening, enlightenment, you're actually experiencing the taste of freedom. It's not freedom yet, because once you have the data, the second part of the jhanas, which is very vital, is it suppresses the five hindrances which distort perception and cognition. So you start to see, when the Buddha said there's no self in here, that the body with its senses is suffering, then actually you see that. You come out afterwards knowing that this, well, most people would, at least it's pretty obvious that, you know, this body is a pain. And people say, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you should get a life. Go and listen to beautiful music. Go and see a sunset. See the birth of a child. A lot of these stuff, you realize, I'm gross, it's shit. Compared to the bliss of the deep meditations. So, it puts this body in context. And number one, number two, yes, you understand what this will is. The sankhara. The house builder. You've actually seen it only when it disappears. Things which are always here, you can't know. The ambient sound, the taste of saliva in your throat, is only when it vanishes can you understand what it truly is. The vanishing of stuff is the meaning of anicca. What was always there is suddenly taken away. And now this thing we call will is not belong to you at all. It disappears. And oh, what bliss to not have any will.
I'd just like to respond and reinforce the importance of...
Oh, sorry. Okay, how's that? Okay. Because I fully agree that this is not a path of attainment, this is a path of relinquishment. And I consider it to be a training in relinquishment, a training in letting go.
Now, sure, if we could just let go, you'd only need the instruction of those two words, and then you'd be enlightened. But most of us need a little training in this. We need to develop the ability to let go. We need to convince ourselves that letting go is actually good. There's no loss in it. And so in the first step, just to enter jhana, as Ajahn has said, we have to let go of the hindrances, and we have to withdraw our attention from our preoccupation with the sense world, with sense desire. And when we have experienced jhana and experienced the joy and the happiness that comes when we're not caught up in the realm of sensual desire, when we re-encounter pleasant sensual experiences, we will do so from a very different perspective. Because we will know that happiness cannot be found that way. Because we will have from its absence, as you said, we will know a higher happiness. We will know something else. And so by experiencing sustained states of absorption in which the hindrances are absent, and then we encounter a pleasant experience, it's still a pleasant experience. But the tendency for lust and sensual desire to arise in relationship to it is greatly diminished.
So I just want to underscore this letting go, because you both have nodded to that as crucial to the practice. And it's a letting go, and it may be counterintuitive for people who are first coming to these instructions, because you hear about jhana 1, 2, 3, 4, it's like levels, and there's this idea of absorption, and absorption feels like there's a movement towards something. So absorption comes through letting go. And then also, it seems what you're saying is that the insight comes through the absence of things, right? So this is interesting. The meditation instruction is to let go, and then the payoff is the insight through the absence of things. So I think this is very profound. I also wanted to ask then, like you just said, it's not as easy as those two words, letting go. So how does someone move their practice deeper? What's the sort of instructions that you give? And I'll hand that to both of you to answer that. Ajahn Brahm, do you want to start us off?
Okay. Well, you can imagine this. I was going to fill this glass full of water. It's a thing which I've demonstrated many times. How do you keep a glass of water perfectly still? Holding it, even being mindful of it, will never keep this still. If it was an open glass, it would actually start moving even more. It's one of the reasons these states are usually called concentration. I much prefer stillness. And states of letting go, it's not you do the letting go, that letting go happens. You can't do letting go. You let go of doing. Or basically the doer just disengages. Come on, let go. Let go. Let go. You can see that's coming from a sense of will. It's the person disappears. You're not there, and letting go is what happens when you do nothing. So the only way to keep this perfectly still is just stop grasping. Stop holding. Put it down. Renounce. Relinquish. Stop. All these wonderful words, which you've probably heard so many times, but are so difficult to do because you try to do it. Vanish. Don't be there. And letting go happens as an automatic process. In spite of you, not because of you.
One of the things that I appreciate about the jhana practices is to actually take a fairly systematic approach to training the mind to let go. So it's an increasing appreciation and love of letting go. Many times I think in our conditioned world we train ourselves to hold on or to accumulate or to gain in some way. And that training becomes one of realizing the alignment with truth that happens, or the alignment with how things are, or peace, when we are not contriving. But nevertheless, I feel as though there's a very strong role for intention in the practice. To have a very clear right intention, and to have a very clear skill in right effort. And because jhana practice can really show when we're forcing, or when we're lazy, or when we're not meeting the object, or when we're meeting it through the lens of self-interest and wanting, it becomes a fabulous training vehicle for really working with right effort, so that it's very, very balanced and can meet the experience of a very simple meditative perception in a way that doesn't distort it, but allows for the deepening of mindfulness, the continuity of mindfulness, and the deepening of samadhi and insight. So I take these absorption states fairly systematically, more so, I think, than what I'm aware of that you do. And when somebody other, I agree that people can drop into these states, sometimes doing other practices or sometimes without even knowing what they are. When somebody in a retreat tells me this, I say sloppy. Sloppy. And I want to go systematically so that they develop the clarity of what the conditions were that allowed that release to happen, what the experience of the release was, what the state of mind was that the mind was absorbed in, and are able to re-experience that whenever they want, so that they know the path of entry and they know the experience of the exit. So I don't like students to go wiggling around through the absorptions until they've already gone through kind of like 1, 2, 3, 4 in a systematic way and have developed some degree of mastery over all four of them. Then they can play with them as they wish.
Yes. I would say that's a very dangerous path. It's great we have a dialogue because differences, because in differences, sometimes I make up the differences when they're not there just to emphasize a point. Even the right intention, the samasankhapa, you know, some of these words need retranslating urgently, because it's not really intention. The samasankhapa is number two of the Eightfold Path. It's coming from renunciation, nekama sankhapa, from metta, loving kindness, avayapada sankhapa, and ahimsaka, non-sort of violence. So gentleness. And that is almost a non-effort. And it's the effort, especially in the English language, says it's somebody doing that. You're striving for something. Instead, I prefer, again, a metaphor which Ajahn Chah taught me, which I thought was absolutely ridiculous and stupid when I first heard it, but I always remembered it for some reason. And that was, his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, was like a mango orchard. The mango trees had been planted by the Buddha himself, and those mango trees were full of ripe, juicy mangoes, but there was only one way to get those mangoes which were produced by the Buddha. And that was not to climb the tree, not to throw things up the tree, not to sort of shake the tree, not even to get a cherry picker, you know, or a helicopter. There's only one way to get those mangoes, and that was to sit perfectly still underneath that mango tree and hold your hand out, and a mango will fall. Sounded stupid, but my goodness, Ajahn Chah was on the money. If you try and shake, nothing falls. But where I do agree with you there, the effort should be actually to say stop. Stop trying to climb the tree. Stop trying to make it happen. And remember the causes, how these things actually happened. Why that jhana occurred. And recreate the causes rather than try and recreate the effect. And now from those jhanas, so the effort is an effort to stop. To, you know, find out what you're trying to do, what you're trying to attain. Get the ego out of the way, because that's what the ego does. It does stuff. And tries to attain. Spiritual materialism. Be very careful of that. I've got the first jhana. How many have you got? I've got more than you've got. Da, 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 da. Unfortunately, that happens.
I think we need like a 3-hour conversation here, because there's some real cool territory to get into, this idea of dropping the will versus this idea of using intention. In practice, I don't think they might be contradictory, but we need 3 hours to work that out. I wanted to ask, maybe Ajahn Brahm, I had a question. So we talk about jhanic states and the dropping away of these five senses disappearing, as you said. Then, and what this is the absence of these things, then start, and then coming back into the world, you start to get insights about impermanence. So, do you need to have jhana? Couldn't, you know, just meditating on sound give you a similar insight into the impermanence of sound?
No. And the reason is, the simile, which I'm sure you realize I was going to say, the best simile which I came up with was a tadpole living in the water, born in the water, spent all its life in the water, and she studies water, she goes to university, she even studies Abhidhamma on the nature of water, because the lake is in a monastery. But how on earth can a tadpole understand what water is It can't understand the nature of water no more than a fish can, because it's always there. But now imagine the little tadpole grows legs and arms. She does not know what's going on, but she becomes a frog. And the frog jumps out of the water. And when it jumps out of the water, that is weird. That is strange. Something which has always been there is now missing. Water. Now, little tadpole, she can understand. No, now a frog can understand what water is. How can you really understand this human body until it disappears? How can you understand the will when it's always been there for you? You may not push the buttons to actually to exercise your will, but you can leave this hall whenever you want. It's there for you. What happens if you can't find that button at all? It's turned off. But there is no will. Now you can understand what will is and how so many people are manipulated by governments, by friends, by advertising. The will is not yours. Not me, not mine, not a self. It doesn't belong to you. And that is one of the scariest things to realize, but also one of the most liberating ones.
So I love the frog tadpole analogy. So then my question that arises for me is, what about the realization of the oxygen of the sixth mental consciousness? How does that come about?
Ask me or you?
Yeah, for you. Okay. And then
Well, what happens next is the second jhana is within the first jhana. It's almost like a special case of a first jhana. And the third jhana is inside the second jhana. You don't go out of the second jhana. It's just more things disappear. They stabilize and disappear. And then to the fourth jhana. And for the fourth jhana, imagine. I like changing words over. Instead of equanimity, contentment. So content, so still. And this is a peak of mindfulness. You don't have more mindfulness than this, ever. So you're fully awake, but so poised. Wherever there's stillness, things disappear. So you get the great vanishing of what we call the arupa attainments, the immaterial attainments. By little, your mental faculties, the sixth sense, vanishes and disappears and ceases. Experience the cessation of all that's felt and perceived.
So cessation. So Shaila, you want to say something on this particular topic?
Just briefly, yeah. One of the most noticeable things that one experiences the mind, the jhana mind, as having an absence of is the activity of the defilements. Mm-hmm. And there's such sustained states that it's not just a short period where the mind is not engaged in anything related to sensual desire, to aversion, towards conceit, towards selfing, towards whatever the defilements are. But they're extended periods of time. So the meditator really knows the wholesome mind. And then there's the opportunity for that wholesome mind to, it's like the cells, it's not a physical experience, but it's like our entire being is resonating with the possibility of purity of mind. And I think the absence of the hindrances in those states has a profound effect that really lasts long after the absorption. So that's one more thing that is really let go.
Yeah. So Ajahn Brahm's making the case that jhanic states are necessary for liberation, for cessation, right? He's very strong. He seems very strong on that position. Do you agree with that position? And if you do, how realistic is it for someone, you know, who's working, Monday to Friday, got things to do on the weekend, you know, how realistic is for a lay practitioner to achieve jhanic states?
Well, I take those as two very different questions. For full and complete enlightenment, I can't say. According to the suttas, I think a strong argument can be made that absorption jhana is necessary for full, complete arhant awakening. But I can't say. There's some arguments that say it's not necessary. But for and for some degree of awakening, perhaps just to a level of the insight into not self, maybe it's not necessary. The necessity of it is not so much a concern to me, because for me this is a process of purifying the mind, and this is a system that allows us to experience the purified mind and to really get to know it. So when we undertake a practice to abandon greed, hate, and delusion in all forms, and there's a possibility of meditating in a way in which no greed, hate, or delusion is arising in any form, I mean, sign me up.
Yeah.
I want to learn it, right?
Definitely.
And I want to experience it, and I want to allow the familiarity of those states through the samadhi to then inform the insight. Because I know my mind, it still wants to cling even though I know better. I mean, I've known things change for a long time, and I still hold on to them. I know they can't provide me lasting satisfaction, and I know that there's no enduring self, and yet the mind is conditioned to still go with those. So until my mind is really fully willing to let go completely forever, then I want to do whatever I can in my meditation practice to nurture those states. And I see jhana practice as being a training ground for this, to really familiarize ourselves with that experience of that clarity and purity of mind. Is it necessary? I really can't say. Is it helpful? Yes. Can we do it? Can we do it? Okay, I shouldn't have said that word. Can we let go into it? Can we realize it? Can we experience it? Can this be part of the way that we perceive the mind? Yes. As a layperson in busy life, it's possible. But it's not easy because it requires conditions. And so the conditions require abandoning all the hindrances. So you have to consider that aspect of abandoning the hindrances. And I also think that hindrance of restlessness and of the conceiving of self is a really sticky one, especially for busy people. And that could be busy monastics as well as busy lay people. But I think busy lay people have a lot of things that we're juggling in a lot of different realms. And so the busyness of constructing, I have to do, I'm busy doing this, how did that work out, blah, blah, blah. You know, all the things with our responsibilities that often reinforce who we are and what we need to do. They keep us busy, and they keep the mind restless, and they keep the mind active. So I do think we need retreats. We need a condition in which we can physically step away from it. I know many people who can maintain access to jhana as lay people in daily life. But I don't know anybody who was able to do it the first few times outside of retreat. So though we have to learn it under pristine conditions, and then our mind understands how it's such a good thing. It's so much better to let go than to hold on. It really is. And then we can do it and experience it in our daily lives. But it does require the conditions, and not everybody has done the work to create those conditions in their daily lives.
I think that's a really important point. Two points you're making. First is that this is a path of purification of the mind. And as inconvenient as it might seem, this requires retreat practice to get full advantage of that and to progress.
I hate to say that it requires retreat practice, because I never see anywhere in the suttas that the Buddha went on a 10-day retreat. Well, okay, he went off to the forest for 2 weeks and he did certain things. But, like, you know, they didn't, it's not exactly what we do where we go to a retreat center.
Yes.
So I hate to say that it's required. I just don't know anybody that those conditions, I mean, retreats are designed for samadhi.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that it's become fashionable to say that, you know, meditation isn't really about achieving these transcendent states that, and then hoping that some of the majesty of the transcendent state trickles down into daily life. But actually, meditation is about just being with our very human thoughts and feelings and emotions and not trying to escape them. When you hear things like that, what do you think? Maybe Ajahn Brahm.
I mean, the whole language just confused the issue. You cannot escape them. You disappear and then escape happens. Mm-hmm. So it's the whole idea of understanding this non-self. And even to let go, you can't let go. You try it. I once thought I was smart and developed a simile of the hand. Because I often notice myself, I'm not doing anything, I pick things up, I hold on to this, I hold on to the microphone. And I thought the only way that I can cut off my, to let go of things permanently, once and for all, is to cut off my hand. When I don't have a thing which does the grasping, then I will let go forever. And I told the monks at the time, that's a simile of the hand. And I thought how smart I was that I invented that until I found this in the Samyutta Nikaya. So the Buddha got there before me. The hand is your mind. That's what it does. Even this was the saying which I saw years ago on the wall of the philosophy department in Cambridge University. And sometimes I get the names wrong, or I mix up the first two. And it was, to do is to be, which was René Descartes, the French philosopher. Underneath that, turn it around, instead of to do is to be is to do, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existential philosopher. And underneath that was a modern American philosopher, do-be-do-be-do, Frank Sinatra. Now, I have to tell some sort of funny story, no matter how serious this conversation is, but that is an important point. Where there is a doer, there is a beer. Where there's being, there's doing. Which is one of the reasons to get stillness, for actually to let go and stop the doer, you have to abandon the being. The bhavadanha, the craving to exist, the attachment to being. And it is just muddying the waters to call this becoming. It's not becoming, it's actually being, bhava, present tense. Not bhava, bhava, which is another sort of form of that word, a derivative, which is actually make, become. This is being. So the idea of letting go of the craving to be, which is the strongest of all of the attachments and cravings which the human being can feel. To do that, we have to totally let go. And that's why it's scary. Because you're not there anymore. You're gone, baby. You're gone. Sorry, that's my nature.
Sometimes people do experience fear when they first enter these absorption states because they're so unfamiliar, they're so different. It's not unusual to find a student a little bit shocked at, whoa, and they come right out, or they're agitated a little bit by their first experience of it. But when we look at the state, we find that there's nothing to fear in them. They're beautiful states that are joyous and wholesome. We find not a trace of defilement in them. And when we take a moment to actually reflect on what that state was, that may have been quite unfamiliar because we're not processing information now through the sense doors in terms of what is to my advantage, which is a kind of an ordinary way of perceiving things. But we're absorbed with our meditation subject in a with sublime joy. It really can be shocking, and not everybody experiences fear, but some people do, and I think it's worth mentioning that.
Even the Buddha experienced it. Before he became enlightened, he said, why should I be afraid of that bliss in jhanas, which has nothing to do with the world? And he was remembering his first experience under the rose apple tree as a young kid. And then he said, I will not be afraid. Maybe this is the path to Bodhi, enlightenment, awakening. And he realized, yes, this is the path. And that's why he developed those jhanas under the Bodhi tree.
Yeah, And it's a beautiful example of how we can let go and also see clearly what is the experience, and let go and see clearly what it is. So it's not just like being pulled into some altered experience blindly. We're actually seeing what that is, and there's a reflection on the wholesome state. And there's a sense of it leading to the profound experiences of release.
Yes. That idea that you feel, you know, when you first experience these jhanas, this is powerful, this is scary as hell, but it's going to take me to somewhere really amazing, wonderful. And then if you look at sort of how the Buddha described them, it reinforces. The Buddha experienced the fear as well. It makes you feel in good company. And also that as it sort of draws you in, you let go, allow it to happen. Especially you have the confidence. It's one of the reasons why I'm very glad that we're here, you're teaching this and I'm teaching this. There's nothing to fear. There's beautiful wisdom and insight. You will not get stuck in the jhanas. What will happen is you get enormous wisdom. And it transcends gender. It transcends, you know, any sort of age. It transcends any tradition.
Okay.
Oh, hey, yeah. But that is one danger, which I often say. But people who do a lot of jhanas, I'm sorry, Shayla, but there is a danger. You may lose your hair.
Is that a sign?
Yeah.
So if people are encountering this fear, what do you instruct them?
To go for it. Look, we have so many fears in our modern society. And sometimes people go, what would you see the other day? Somebody doing a jump off the cliffs. And they want to do this. They want to go riding in fast cars. There's many things they're afraid of. Why be afraid of something which you feel is blissful, pure? And why you hear, you know, from... This is one of the reasons I speak here, to try and say, look, please do not be afraid. Well, hopefully that you've known me and Shayla for long enough to know that we don't... I don't get anything out of this. I'm not trying to exploit you. I'm not trying to get more disciples. I've got more than enough. Do you want some? All this is because I was afraid. I'm making a claim now. Okay, but anyway, I know a monk I'm very close to who was really scared, was blissed out, and wondered what the heck are these states. And because no one had ever told me about them, they'd never been explained to me. They were there, but I never understood them. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, that I have to share them with you. I have to sort of feel an obligation, so that if those things start to happen and you get these beautiful lights in the mind, energies, so the hindrances start disappearing, you can't feel any of your body, you can't hear anything, go for it. The pleasure is sometimes something which draws you in because it's amazing, perfectly pure and wholesome. You can feel that. As you said, you can taste. This is leading to something which is incredible and totally wholesome. There's nothing in there which even has a smell of attachment. Purely wholesome, no hindrances, clear seeing, and you get into those places and you will never ever regret it. So that's why, don't be afraid.
So we're not going to be afraid. Shala, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about nimitta.
The term nimitta is often used in the practices of jhana, and it basically means sign, mark. It can be an ordinary term. It doesn't necessarily mean the only reference to nimitta is not just to the samadhi nimitta. You can find it for any sign. That's the way perception operates, is we know through signs. We know through mental signs of things what something is. But there is a transformation not only of the qualities of happiness that occur in the deepening of samadhi, but there's a transformation of the way that we know our meditation subject. For example, if you're using a perception like the breath, such as the breath, that's a common and very versatile object for meditation. You can perceive the breath in many different ways. You can perceive changing sensations of the breath, but it's also possible to maintain a continuity of mindfulness on breath in such a way that the physicality of the sensations disappears from perception, and now the breath becomes known as a mental sign of the breath. That is perceived slightly differently for different people, but it's very frequently perceived as a luminosity in the mind, a mental knowing of breath. And so this now is a mental sign, and mind can very easily absorb with this mental experience. So it's not now having to go out and process a tingle, a cold, a pressure, a rising, a falling, a this and a that, all the changing experiences of breath. But it has a steady and very subtle, very beautiful, subtle perception where the mind can rest and absorb through that perception that was derived from the breath. But you can also there's other kinds of nimittas that develop with other meditation practices. But I think maybe the breath is the most common of the practices, at least that are taught in the contemporary circles that I wander through.
Ajahn Brahm, could you talk a little bit about the relationship between the breath and nimitta?
Yes, I totally agree with you there. But so what happens is that you can read this in the Anapanasati Sutta, that when you get deeper into the breathing, you experience this not as a kaya sankara, but as a chitta sankara. It is the mental image of the breath. But that also comes with a lot of piti sukha, joy and happiness, delight. And that joy and happiness shows us how strong this mind is. And that joy and happiness gets very intense sometimes. Again, don't be afraid of that. And the nimittas, as far as the development of jhanas are concerned, please excuse me, he's a great monk, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, but sometimes I do scold him for some of his translations. And there is a whole sutta on how to develop the nimittas. It's called the Upakalesa Sutta. But unless you know Pali, then you miss it, because Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi always translates as that thing. And when I scold him, I said, well, it's in the footnotes. It's like, you know, when you have a contract to buy a car, and he said, well, it's in the footnotes, you know, you have to buy your own steering wheel or something. So it's there, but people miss it. And I say this because I take the opportunity. People say, the Buddha never mentioned nimittas in the context of jhana. So what are you talking about? It's there. Sometimes I get it mixed up. I'll imagine a 128, I think. 108 is a Gopika Moggallana Sutta. Sometimes I get it the other way around. It's there. All the different defilements and how you actually work with these nimittas in order to calm them down, brighten them up, strengthen them, until they're strong enough to draw you in to these jhana states. So those nimittas are brilliant. And I tell this because many people have these experiences. They're meditating, there's beautiful lights in the mind. Or sometimes they flow through the minds. Now that's like firework nimittas or ping pong nimittas. And just how you deal with these things and why they are like that. And also, sometimes it's not always seen as a light, totally agree with you. And sometimes for a couple of years, some of the meditators were saying that when they were meditating, that they could smell like almost like a jasmine smell or a rose smell, something very beautiful. And that wasn't in the hall. It wasn't in their nose. It was how their mind was perceiving this. And I thought this must be some heavenly beings visiting or something. And realize, no, it's not the heavenly beings or anything like that. It's a nimitta of the nose, of smell. So sometimes, more rare sound nimittas, they're not so common, in my anecdotal experience. But light nimittas are usually the most powerful. And it's also, I'm going to take the opportunity here, is one disciple meditator over in Kuala Lumpur, when he saw the light limiter, he told me it was really dirty, like a white cloth which had been like overused and had coffee stains on it. And I said, what have you been doing? Because when you see a limiter, it's like a reflection of your mind. And if you've been misbehaving, breaking precepts, lying, letting somebody down, you see that in your mind. As a reflection, you're on your limiter. And you can't deny this. This is where your precepts and your purity of mind, your giving, your generosity, your reliability, and of course you know there's some people who are just naturally just such pure-hearted people. And this is one of the first payoffs you have for your precepts, not just precepts, your kindness, your giving, your generosity. The sort of person who, if you need a lift anywhere, forget what I'm doing, I'll give you that lift. There's always serving. And those people, when the nimittas come up, whoa, they're mind-blowing, they're beautiful. Because you're seeing a reflection of your mind. And you can't deny it. You get the insights into the importance of meditation, of your precepts, of your generosity, of your goodness, of your kindness. And that's direct, you can't miss it.
So we're almost out of time, or we are out of time, but and we're almost to the first jhana, so we're going to have to come back and do this again. And I'll invite Bhikkhu Bodhi for the next one. That'll be fun. Yeah. And so I think that'll be a great discussion. But Shaila, did you want to finish with some words about encouragement for us all to go out and practice deep states of meditation?
Yes, good. That's exactly right. Go for it. I do think that sometimes meditators sell themselves short and think that they need decades or years or months in retreat in order to even approach these states. But if we have the right attitude and we recognize, as Ajahn is saying, that right concentration is based upon virtue, then as we're practicing our virtue, we are clearing the mind. We're clearing the space. As we work with the hindrances skillfully, then we'll be able to let them go. There are so many things that we can do in daily life to eliminate or work more skillfully with the things that kind of are corruptions to our mind or that perpetually distract us. And if we do a little bit here and there, we do create greater conditions, better conditions for concentration. And at some point, those conditions mature. So I guess I just want to say, don't sell yourself short. Give yourself the respect to cultivate this path. And this path includes samadhi. It's not just for somebody who's spent 20 years in a cave. It's for every meditator to cultivate samadhi. And it is available. It's not that every one of us is going to experience jhana in our next retreat. We can't predict that.
But everybody can.
It's possible. It's possible. It depends upon conditions, and we can cultivate those conditions. Sometimes I feel like a little bit of a cheerleader for it. But I do think one of the things that I've appreciated about this conversation is one of the things that sometimes the cheering for is, oh, what blissful states. Oh, what happy states. Oh, what joyous, rapturous states. They are. But the real essence of the cheering is the letting go. It's to know the mind of peace. It's to know the purity of the mind, the beauty of the mind that is not corrupted by the defilement. And that's what brings the great joy.
Excellent. So, I know that the jhana practice was absent from Buddhism for many years. And I do remember that even when Ayakema came to visit Bodhinyana when I'd just taken over as the boss, the teacher, and I invited her to give the talk to all the monks, sit on the high Dhamma seat and give a talk, which took her back a little bit. I've always wanted equity. And then she said afterwards, she gave a talk on jhana. She said, that probably upset you, didn't it? I said, no, we talk about those all the time. And she was really quite stunned. And I remember going to another monastery, and I was talking about jhanas. And one of the monks, as soon as I came out of the reception area, he grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled me aside, and he looked around to make sure that no one was listening, and he whispered, thank you for teaching jhanas. It was like I was sharing pornography or something. Because it wasn't done. And all those, that really encouraged me to teach more. Anything which is forbidden. Which is not outside my precepts. And then, just give it a try. To teach lay people. And I don't know, maybe because I'm just maybe too much of a socialist brought up, because I was come from a poor family. But why should you stop certain people from enjoying the jhanas? So people tell me, well, maybe teach your monks and maybe some nuns, but don't teach the lay people. And that really encouraged me. So let's give it a try. And what happened is many lay people have experienced those jhanas. Even if it's they haven't continued with them, but just having them once and having an idea of what these things are, that is really important. So that's why I thank you for allowing this conversation. You can. As Obama said, we can.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you, Sala. And thank you, all of you. Thank you so much.